And the subject tonight is the human-animal bond, animal-facilitated therapy, and the blessings of animals. And my name is Leo Buston. And it's essentially a slide presentation. And in today's world, animals are becoming very prominent. I just recently was in Japan, and they sent me a journal in which they had quoted me and some things I had said there. I don't know what I said, and I can't tell by the magazine, but but this is a pretty good portrayal of even rabbits are superior to people on today's tube. And here you see this chimp with his distressed lad who's down to one banana. The chimp already has four in his pocket and has eaten one. And the boy has lost the last game. And the chimp wants his last banana. So that's how it goes. And this is a guy named Nick, K-N-I-C-K. If you want a song for one of your pets or all of them, one lady had eight cats and she had a song for each of them, you can get a song, he'll compose a song for you, send you a tape of it and the lyrics. And it's $35 a throw. You have to tell him something about the personality of the animal and a few other things. To give you an example of a couple of his productions, this is one to a cat. I love to watch you chase the sun from room to room. Early every morning, you wake me with a meow. I have to get out of bed and feed you right now. Or here's one for a turtle. Simple Simon is my turtle, that's all he'll ever be, but even though he's just a turtle, he means much more to me. And also Nick thought that in Jaws, the shark got a bad deal. So he wrote a shark song. I am a shark, a great white shark swimming after you. I wish I could walk across the land, then I'd eat your grandmother too. Some of the lyrics are not really first rate, but for $35, that's pretty good. One of my recent interests and the remarkable thing that I see in difference between the Andeans, and the camelid family, the llamas and alpacas. And here you see a llama there. They're a very interesting beast, and their human-animal interaction with a llama is far different than it is in the Andes. They're essentially utilitarian, and here they're really pets, and a remarkable pet. I'll have more to say about that later. I just came back from the International Llama Association. I was asked to speak there in Salt Lake City the other day. Last Thursday, I think it was. It just started 7 years ago. There were 75 at the first meeting, and there were 800 there the other day. And a lot of, I didn't count the llamas. And you could have bought one anywhere from a few thousand to 40 or 50,000 a throw. A friend of mine, the stud fee for their best one is 5,000. A goal. Now, if you want a llama, a llamagram, you can get one if you call up Nick. Florence thinks it's Sumner. And she does this all up and down the coast. This happens to be a guy who's he's an accountant for Pacific Power and Light. And he had done a lot of things to his sister through the years on her birthday. So she thought it was time for him. It was his turn. So he called up Florence. She called up Florence from California and said he needs a llamagram. So in his office one day on his 40th birthday, she comes waltzing in with her llama and sings the telegram. And you can do that. It varies the price where it is. This happened to be in Bellevue. She also goes into schools and nursing homes. In fact, percentage-wise, I imagine more lamas are used in situations where you might call it bonding or in therapy or modification to that. Then probably dogs and cats percentage-wise, but there are only 25 or 30,000 in this country. So a few hundred goes quite a ways using this. While there are about 50 million dogs and 56 million cats, we are now one of five nations that have more cats than dogs. We're not going to the dogs, we're going to the cats. What I'm going to talk about is the human-animal bond. And rather than define it vigorously, I show it to you. And this is Wayne Williams and Kubla. You know what Kubla is? It's a hippopotamus. And obviously there's a strong bond there. Mutual trust, close attachment. And he did her a great favor. I don't have time to go into it, but a beautiful story on Kubla. She was born September 14th, 1975 in Portland, Oregon. And her mother, there was something wrong, so she got an early divorce. And was raised with a Barbary sheep, and she thought she was a Barbary sheep, or Kubla didn't. He thought he was a Barbary sheep. Wayne Williams is great. He's at Woodland Park Zoo. And before he died from cancer, he convinced Kubla that he was a hippopotamus. But they've shared lunch together, and his right foot's his right leg's probably asleep. But all attachments aren't for good. I've been associated almost all my life with animals. Except sometimes in infantry combat through much of the war. And I didn't have a lot except when we captured horses, which was better than walking. But when I got in prison camp, I had a very close attachment to fleas, lice, and bedbugs, but that is not a good bonding. I take this very seriously, our charge from The Little Prince, which is one of my favorite books. But if you tame me, then we shall need each other. To me, you will be unique in all the world. To you, I shall be unique in all the world. You become responsible forever for what you have tamed. And as a veterinarian, we are also responsible for what we have not tamed. And we take that responsibility very seriously. I'm also going to mention pet facilitated therapy, or animal assisted therapy. It has many names. This is my analyst here. When you're a dean, that's about the only friend you have. And some of those bite you. In therapy, I'm using a broad definition of it: waiting on, attendance, a service, fostering, nurturing, or tending to the sick, divine worship service, giving medical treatment, and paying court. And that's from the Greek, English, it's tending to the sick as well as extending medical treatment with the object of curing, healing, or giving care. And I can start with our own home. Now, you've all met my wife here. Her name is Signe, and she's has another dog now. But this was an earlier dog. She complained a lot about me being gone so much when I was at the University of California. So I said, well, we'll get this dog. And got this dog. She asked me what we should call it. And I said, well, we'll call it Great Reluctance, so that whenever I leave you, I can leave you with Great Reluctance. She threw the waffle iron at me. No, she really didn't. She would never do that. To show you how far people go with this, and some of you have seen this before, but my wife was driving for a long time a white rabbit, which I guess is appropriate. I was afraid to ride with her. But this is, the caption on this is, although Great Reluctance is 16 years old, he still loves to chase cars. She now has another dog, which most of you have seen, and you will see it in action here. We'll have a small demonstration on Thursday night when we talk about assistance animals. Some remarkable things are happening with assistance animals today. A lot of people living independently. And that dog is her freedom, because I'm gone a lot. And now I think she's probably happy about it. She's all lucked out. But, and you see, she has an orange harness there and a yellow lead, or an orange lead. The official designation for a hearing dog, a certified hearing dog, is using an orange or yellow leash. And hers has hearing dog on it. The dog is notifying her that the phone is ringing. But we'll have more to say about that on Thursday night. But we didn't invent this. You can go to Denmark and see this. And the person that's riding shotgun is wearing the goggles, the important one. The bond here is exceedingly strong. On all this animal ownership, the critical issue is not whether you have an animal or not, but what is the nature of the bonding. And now we have some attempts at evaluating what is the strength of the bond. And if we have time, I can go into some of this. I can then, in short order, have a council and session with any of you. I could tell you where the bond, what is the status of the bonding. With my wife, of course, it's exceedingly strong. We go back in history, and our bond with one another, with other animals and the natural environment was very strong. It was for survival, and many people regarded some of the earliest cave paintings were utilitarian animals. In the Andes, I think 90% of the cave drawings were of llamas, or the camelids. I learned that last week. Learn a fact today. I'm down to one a week now. But they weren't always for utilitarian purposes. I've gone back into the literature and read about this and found out that there's pretty good evidence that animals very early on were for other reasons than utilitarian. For wool, meat, or PDB, or watchdogs, or garbage cans. It was interesting for me, for example, to visit the Maasai in Kenya. You saw this just a few years ago, and if I would have had a camera 5,000 years ago, I'd probably seen the same thing. And the animals are very important to them for all kinds of reasons, which I won't go into, but it not only a source of companionship, but it was their wealth, very important in religion, and a lot of other things. And this has continued in many cultures for thousands of years. Recently I did a thing for the Smithsonian, coming out in a book, a series of articles in it, and I chose to talk about human-animal bond with dogs and cats to contrast them, but also with the water buffalo. It's a very interesting animal. And one of my intents there was to see, is that a good model for, say, the llamas in South America? Well, it really isn't. It's not a real close analogy, which was somewhat of a disappointment to me. You see, here are these children. You know, they can sleep on the backs of these. They take them on a hot day. They'll take them down and wash them off in the ponds. They'll clean out their eyes and their ears and their mouth. It's a very close attachment. And like one mother said, when I die, they will mourn my loss. But when the buffalo dies, they'll starve. So it's utilitarian, but they are really members of the household. Very strong bonding. But this is to what I was really doing this partially for, is that a lot of people say, well, you only have this bonding and this close attachment to animals in the Western world. But there is evidence for others, but in many countries, of course, they can't afford this. And like the llama people last week, I mean, it really turned them off when the fellow there was from Peru, a veterinarian, talking about Peru and, you know, how they eat, they turn them into jerky. That is not attractive to the llama owners in this country any more than you who love dogs to say, you know, well, we eat them. And this is upsetting many people here with the Vietnamese and others coming here. and going, getting to the animal control center and getting a nice fat dog. So we'll proceed. But what happened after thousands of years? We industrialized, mechanized, urbanized, and for a large segment of our population, they were separated from animals, from the natural environment. And you see, we are by nature nurturers, and we must be nurtured and have suitable objects of nurture if we are to be healthy. And what has happened is that a lot of people, the bond is broken, you see, with the natural environment, with animals, and more recently with one another. Because more and more people are choosing to live alone, many married but choosing not to have children. So we have loneliness, which is probably our worst disease. And we're paying a high price for this. More and more psychiatrists are coming around, the ones I know in a way, in research and all, say that probably one of the big problems, especially with our male population, is a lack of suitable objects of nurture. And as I proceed today, you will realize that the populations I'm dealing most with, locally, regionally, nationally, internationally, where we're going to see the greatest effect, are those who do not have very much nurture. Many of them never had nurture, and do not have suitable objects of nurture. So this bond between people and animals and environment has been fractured. Come on in, there's plenty of room here. And as I've gone back in the literature to find out, were animals used in as therapists or assistant therapists, and there's a rich literature on this. Throughout history, animals or parts of animals have been used for therapy. And here, lap dogs were prescribed many, many years ago. If you had abdominal problems or an assortment of other things, as Pliny said, the pretty little dogs that our dainty dames make so much of, if they ever, and anon, kept close onto the stomach, they ease the pain thereof. Well, I never forget, an associate of mine, in fact, the vice president of Delta Society, which I was president, he was writing to one of our meetings, and the lady next to him, whenever we fly or do anything, we talk about our business, about the greatness of animals, you see. That's part of our charter. And he engaged this lady next to him in a conversation. And she related to him that when she was pregnant, I don't know what number it was, but she said that she had a very vigorous fetus. And sometimes he just kicked the dickens out of her. I mean, it was very uncomfortable. And then she got wise. She got her cat up on her lap and petted it and started to purr and always quieted her unborn child down. Well, we know now that what he says has some scientific basis. Also in those old days, what they do if you're going crazy, they'd issue a dog to carry around. We know that also has some basis. To go back in history, Giel, a fellow named Duvet, wrote it in 1860, but in Giel, Belgium, probably in 800 or 900, they were very concerned with how people were treated in insane asylums, the handicapped people, mentally and physically. They were sort of throwaways. So they decided in Giel they should take them in to live with them. And that's continued till today. And tomorrow, Keith Henson and I will be discussing handicapped and the history sort of asylums and institutions. And they would often have them take care of animals. And I was very interested, for example, to learn from the Andes with the llamas down there. The children usually take care of the llamas, herd them and clean up after them and the scut work. But the handicapped children, they continue it on, in many of them, to adulthood. So they do have, they it's a utilitarian thing, but it's good for the good for them, you see, to have this assignment. And I was very pleased to hear that. And I have involved handicapped people in caring for animals, and some of the best people I've ever had to take care of animals. They talk to them and expect an answer. And if they don't get it, they'll give it to them. I mean, give them the answer. And they really worry about it and work very hard. And that was in Giel. There's some beautiful stories about that. And York Retreat is often recorded. Back in 1792, two Quaker merchants, the Tuke brothers, decided that insane asylums were awful. And they're going to do something about this. So they, by subscription, you could come to the York Retreat. And they fed them well, and they dress up for tea. But most important to me, they had them taking care of animals. Rabbits, chickens, and it was very good for them. And I think that really was probably the start. Maybe others were doing it, but it continued until my youth, really, which is admittedly quite a while ago. But it continued for a very long time. And I think that's where, for example, Bethel, well, at least one of you know about Bethel from Germany. But Florence Nightingale, who's big in nursing, said a small pet is an excellent companion for the sake of petting a bird. Pet bird in a cage is sometimes the only pleasure of an invalid confined in the same room for years. And in Bethel, and I may have more to say about this tomorrow night, depending on our time, but that's one of the most impressive places I've ever been. Edna Hong wrote a lot of great books, but one of them was The Bright Valley of Love. If you haven't read it, you ought to. And that's why I went there, because I knew they used animals in therapy.
But what is it? What is Bethel?
Bethel, or Bethel, City of God. It's a place in Bielefeld, West Germany, called an institution, we call it an institution without walls, where they have over 5,000 people who are disadvantaged, and over 5,000 people that take care of them, and some of the most remarkable facilities I've ever seen. And their farms, and they've been utilizing animals with them since, I guess, they started in 1867. The permanent director came in 1871, whose name was Boldschwing. And his son took over in 1911. A beautiful story. And when I got to be a dean, which is something I never planned on, but I'd already had Alzheimer's. You know what Alzheimer's is? It isn't quite all the way. But I became a dean. I'm sorry I didn't get back to you sooner, Mr. McDonald, but our computers were down. And I decided, you know, if I'm going to do this, for the second time in my life, I had some time on my hands, because I left the University of California. I'd accumulated a lot of leaves, so I came up and I had a couple of months to think. Then I slipped a disc, and then I really had a lot of bedtime to think about it. Where are we as a society relative to our animal or natural environment? So since 1973, I've spent a lot of time looking at this problem. And the first thing I decided, it was down with Descartes. Who thought animals were machines and they had no feeling or consciousness. And I've been fighting that, because some people still believe that, unfortunately, for them and the animals. And in that year of 73-74, when I was looking at the literature available, I realized, I got some data from some people I knew who had made a survey of the animal control centers of the United States. And they weren't sure, but it could be upwards of 18 million dogs and cats were killed that year in their animal control centers. And that isn't all of them. You say, well, they were strays. No, the majority of them were owned by someone. And then I really realized we had a problem. That's a lot of blood in the floor for which we have to take responsibility. And up to 50% of them were there because of behavioral problems. A lot of them were recycled. And I also realized that they were treated very badly. Can we Can you see that all right?
It's
probably not good to have too good a look at it.
You want to see it.
We can, is there some lights we can turn off and still have some lights? I don't know. If you're satisfied, I guess you can see that. Part of our problem is, the wrong person is in charge of the pack, because many of our pets are pack animals. Llamas are, dogs are, and we don't train the animals. So very few people give them obedience training. So we raise juvenile delinquents as dogs. See, he can't even hit the fire plug, and it's called man's best friend. And here's another thing that shook me. I'm a son of immigrant parents, and several things they taught me when I was young. You were kind to livestock. You gentle livestock because they produced better. The lesson didn't extend to the creepy crawly things and the pooky birds. And the other thing was that you respected and were kind to old people and handicapped people. And this sort of stayed with me. And I have visited nursing and combines and old people's homes most of my life. Gives you kind of keeps things in perspective. And there was more recently I've seen a lot of these. And a lot of people, just like this lady, who's just waiting to die. She's sitting there just, she knows she's not needed. And although she may have relatives around, they don't really very come and see her very often. And many of these people will tell you this one of two scenarios. I was happy living alone, independently with my animals. And one of two things happened. Either they ran out of money and had to go into government housing where they were not allowed animals, so they'd take them off and kill them. Or somebody laid a guilt trip on them and said, you know, I really worry about you in here with all your animals all by yourself. You're going to fall down someday. You're not going to be able to get up and nobody's going to find you. I won't find you and I'll never forgive myself. So we're going to take you to this nice home and we'll take care of the animals, meaning in most cases you kill them. Now that's serious business, and I'll tell you why. I know of at least four surveys in the recent past when they asked people, where is the animal in your family? In the surveys, one of them was between 70 and 80%, another one was 80 some percent, another one was 98.7%, the other one was 99% of the people queried said that the animal was a member of the family. And when they asked them which member, they said it was a child. And you can say, well, I don't believe that, but it happens to be true. To many of them, that's their child. And having lost a child, I can tell you it's the ultimate of tragedy. And I don't want any of you ever to say to a person who's weeping over the loss of an animal, what are you crying about? It was just an animal. Huh? Don't do that. And to really bring this home to you. If on July 16th, 1983, when I was weeping bitter tears with Karn's death in Cameroon, where he'd served two remarkable years, if you had come to me and said, what are you crying about? It was just a daughter. You wouldn't say that, would you? By the same token, don't do it to anybody else. Relative to an animal loss. I'm not putting them in equality, but to many people, that's where they're coming from. And for some of them, that's all they got. And with that lady, for example, it was the only thing she had that gave her unconditional love, socialized her, made her feel needed, helped organize her life. There was a dog that required exercise. It was a source of fun and laughter. And there's much of that today, and it's probably our best therapy. It gave her something to touch and to be touched by. And everybody needs tactile stimulation, and the old people aren't getting it. It also was a source of security. And there's no pill that'll do that for you today. Now, what we did, I forgot this doesn't reverse, but you saw the picture. What we did, and we realized we had a lot of problems. One of them was that there was irresponsible animal care, animal regard. In fact, I talked to a lot of veterinarians. I says, how many of your clients are irresponsible animal owners? I was a long time before I met one that said less than 50%. And these are the people that bring their animals to veterinarians. And so he said, it's an education problem. So we went into our school system in two enlightened communities, Moscow, Idaho, Washington State, and Pullman, Washington, home of two universities, 8 miles apart, or seven. And Linda Hines and I went in the school system and said, you know, what are you getting here relative to animals? And the answer was pretty clear why we have irresponsible animal ownership. There's hardly anything in the curriculum about it. And so we did something about it. We started a pet professorship program where the students and other members of the community go in, and we developed a curriculum for this. And we have a laying on of hands. And if you have a dog this size, you can put five on a dog. Cost effective. And here it is, learning and living together, building a human bond. We just revised it. And it's being utilized in quite a few school systems today, preschool to sixth grade, and in a few foreign countries. And when I get to be dictator, it'll be in all the school systems in the world. And here is a curriculum. Getting acquainted with pets, little critters as pets, cats as pets, dogs as pets, wild animals are not pets. The living bond. And more recently we added, a master's candidate did a study on and developed this curriculum, when your best friend is gone, pet loss and bereavement. It's a very important area. This is often the children's first exposure to death. And you have to help them have closure. And it's a very useful thing. I'm on somebody's list. There are more and more compassionate friends groups. There are counseling groups now, informal, sometimes organized, for people that lose animals, or they combine them. And there's lists of these, and in our Delta Society, which I'll tell you a little bit about, it's an international organization, but we keep record of these. But I'm on somebody's list. I get calls every week from across the country. Some of them are inoperative. They're in deep grief with the loss of an animal. And so you allow them to articulate the grief and help them. In our own community, we invite people in, or the clinic will recommend them to us, and we invite them over for tea. And you don't grab them and say, articulate your grief. But you leave it open and you listen to them. I'll never forget what Paul Tournier told me when I presented this problem to him. And all the other questions, he came right up with an answer. But on this, and he didn't answer right away, and he says, you must allow them to articulate their grief, to help them have closure. And I should also point out that animals also suffer separation anxiety and manifest many of the same symptoms as we do in grief with loss, sometimes probably more than we do. Some of them are abused, feed and die. And I'm talking about some lower form, like gerbils. I know two male gerbils. And at 7 and 9, they were with this family, and one of them was killed, and the other one refused, feed and died in 2 days. I could give you a whole story on this. We've written about this. Companion animal partnership is another one. Either placing animals or visiting animals with old people, nursing homes, convalescent homes, or in individuals in homes, or with handicapped people. And we started this off in a class in our school, an elective class, Dean Fluardi. And my wife and I had brought in great reluctance into the local convalescent home. They didn't want it in there. said, well, people trip over it. Well, I carry it in. No, I've got a lot of diseases. Mm-hmm. Biggest disease problem in nursing homes, convalescent hospitals are the people, not the animals. They also have fewer piddles on the floor. But what we did was bring some cats into the nursing homes. And the kittens got to be big cats, and this one got pregnant. And the party then really became informal, and the place has never been the same since. We have farm days, and now all our nursing and convalescent homes in our area have animal visitation or animals, resident animals. And here I'll just give you a couple of examples. Some of you have seen these, but they're sort of representative and classic cases. We don't have time for a lot of them. I could go on for the next 10 hours telling you stories, anecdotal information about this. This is Marie, who was in our local convalescent home where we were not allowed before, but two women bought it and then things changed. And this is Marie, as I say, who had had a stroke, and she was laying in a fetal position in her bed, didn't care whether school kept or not. If you went to talk to her, she'd essentially indicate to bug off. And she also had another problem. She had sores on her legs which wouldn't heal. She kept scratching. Well, we set up a therapy room with Handsome the cat and told the people, now the staff, you can vote who you think should benefit the most by introduction to the cat room, the therapy room. And they all voted for Marie. She'd had a history of cats, and she was kind of a lost cause and desperate. So they moved her in there, and of course a lot of people came in to see the cat. And she also found out, well, she was all healed up in 5 weeks, because whenever she started scratching, the cat would, of course, jump on her hand. You who know cats. So she healed up. In 5 weeks, she was on public television. In 8 weeks, socialized. And so she had 3.5 good years there. Mentating well, I went up to see her. And the Handsome the cat did well, too. And then she died, and then Handsome went with somebody else. But we monitor this very carefully. This is something, hearing me now, you run home and say, you know, run down to the local pound, pick out an animal, drop it off at the nursing home and say, now your troubles are over. They're just starting. I mean, this takes a lot of careful planning. We continually monitor these. We have a volunteer at each nursing home. My program assistant is the president of the National Association of Dog Obedience Instructors. She knows behavior. In fact, she was the one that trained Bridget, which you'll see in a couple of days. So this is something you take seriously, and we also protect the animal. And you must respect the animal. You don't want to overuse the animal. And in this case, what is happening here is that Daisy, the basket case, which is a dog that Eleanor carries around the basket. That's why I got Daisy the basket case. He knows a lot of tricks, but and visits a lot of old people. But here she's visiting the cat. Because they're good buddies, and the dog is overseeing the cat. So it has visiting privilege too. They got to have R&R time. And here's an interesting case. We got a call from the nursing home one day, the convalescent home, said, we need some help. Fill a prescription. Because Walder's doctor says the only thing that's going to help him is a dog. So he wrote RX dog. We know how to pick out dogs, and we went to a lot of dogs before we were on Goof. His head doesn't match the rest of his body, but he doesn't care. Walder doesn't care, and he had to have a dog that wouldn't crush him when he jumped up on his bed, because he's pretty much bedbound. And the nursing home, and I'm working on architects on this. We don't have enough planning of buildings to take care of animals. But it's another thing I'm going to do when I get to be dictator, and respect animals and buildings. But they are very good up there. They just cut a hole in the wall and made a door too small for Walter to get through, but the dog can get through when he plugs it and go outside. So that's another. So more and more you're going to see a prescription for animals. And more of it is happening. A lot of people don't talk about it because it isn't considered very professional. It doesn't fit the model, you see. Although if you, in the quiet of the evening, if you ask a lot of clinical psychologists and psychiatrists, probably up to half of them, that's quite a few years ago, we're involving animals in one way or the other. And this is a, I like this case because I'm an old sheep herder. I love sheep. And this is some friends of mine from Dillon, Montana sent me this. And this girl wanted to raise a 4-H lamb in downtown Dillon. But she didn't have enough room, so she went uptown Dillon, where the nursing home was. Now, what do you think inhabits the nursing homes in Dillon, Montana? Sheep herders, that's right. She got more on sheep than she bargained for. But she had a prize-winning sheep and a lot of help. There's one of them out there, and that's no better combination for old people than kids and animals. And so she had a prize-winning sheep. An Australian stockman heard about it, and so he bought it and gave it back to him. Well, the chief and I, we were so impressed with this. So I went to Dillon, Montana the summer after. And she was a year older. She had two lambs in the nursing home. She'd bought a dog for the nursing home director, called it by his name, so he couldn't very well get rid of it. The other thing here, the end two rooms of this building is a daycare center. It's another thing I'm going to do when I get to be daycare. You have children there, the animals, and the daycare center. So I'm describing utopia. And we have put out guidelines, my associate's guidelines for animals in nursing homes. It's been recently revised. The first shipment, exhausted. It's being utilized in a lot of places. It tells you how to pick them up and how to do it. And we're now revising our how to start a people-pet partnership. And we're going with that. And here, I got to tell you about this llama. His name is Darwin. And it's Senator Fakes, one of Senator Fakes' llamas. She's a senator in Anchorage. She has others too, and if you go to her house, it may answer the door or be right there, because it spends a lot of time indoors. But here it's obviously, it visits a lot of nursing homes, college homes in Anchorage, and they're using them a lot for that now. And prison partnership. As a former prisoner myself, a prisoner of war, I have a lot of compassion for lockup, people in lockup. And I teamed up with a girl on the right there named Kathy. We've been incarcerated 35 times in 14 different institutions from the age of 13 to 20. Permanently scarred from this experience. And she and I talked a lot about what we could do for prisoners now. And she met up with this handicapped person here, who some of you may recognize. He used to be in charge of the Independent Living Center at Puyallup, Washington, Bert Push. He's probably a thalidomide. His hands, you don't see him there. Well, you see one finger, only one finger on the left hand. And she said, and I talked to her before, and she had a wheelchair. I said, get a wheelchair and train your dog. She could train a dog to do anything. In fact, dogs are what saved her. And she says, here's what we're going to do. I'll get two of the best trainers I can find. We'll go out to the maximum security prison for women out here at Purdy, which is now the Washington Correctional Center for Women. And we'll train them to train animals to help handicapped people. And they're going to meet the person they're training for. And then I says, you're going to do one other thing. You're going to do obedience training of animals in the animal control center. Because everybody can't train to them. For what you need to train for on special dogs. She didn't like that idea, but eventually she did. And here are some of the trainers and the prisoners. I want to especially call your attention to the second one from the right. His name is Sue. Sue is now a hero to 38 people. She's a lifer for reasons. She's an excellent trainer. We got money, private money, an unnamed source. To build a kennel in the prison. And I'll only tell you about one of the cases. I may tell you some more on Thursday night. But that's Angie. Angie was the second or third dog, Sheba was the second or third dog that Sue trained. The first dog she trained was for Bert Push there. And it changed his life. And it really changed Angie's life. Because Angie was a person that was born with a whole array of seizures, up to 14. From birth to 14 years of age, required the presence of her mother or father at all times, night and day. When she was up, she was tied to her wheelchair. They didn't always catch her in time, and she'd quit breathing and wipe out her memory. So she'd keep starting over. Well, they took her down, introduced her to Sue, trained Sheba to help her pick up things, pull her wheelchair, and do a lot of things. But the dog picked up on her seizures and knows when she's going to have a seizure before she knows she's going to have a seizure, which gives her lead time sometimes to relax and maybe even abort the seizure or get intervention. In fact, just a week ago, she was down at a bus stop with her dog, and the dog detected the seizure coming on. They got help for her and just got her into the hospital on time because her heart stopped, everything stopped. And had he not, of course, she would not be with. She has now finished junior high and high school work. She competed in the Special Olympics a year ago last August, took gold, won gold, three or four bronze, was third overall in gymnastics. As far as I know, and last I heard, she has a boyfriend. Shows her dog in dog show. Now, I'm not saying she's going to have a normal life, but she and her mother, and we know that it's a miracle. Now, there are now two other dogs they have that detect seizures before they know that seizure. And Keith and I are now evaluating a proposal by the Epileptic Foundation that wants to money from the Delta Society to do a study on this. I've been very anxious to say there'd be a great market for these dogs. Partnership in equine therapy and education. Remarkable things that happen to a person by riding. It's hard to imitate the three-dimensional movement of a horse. It's a bit like walking. That's why people that haven't walked before with extended hippotherapy developed by the Germans are able to walk again. Muscle strength and coordination. And I have a friend in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Ruth Dismuke, who has third-party payment for speech therapy on a horse. She found out that if you put them on a horse and give speech therapy, it's a lot better than in a classroom. There's a long and interesting history on this, which we can't go into, but when you take a child like this or in a wheelchair looking up all his life, suddenly vaulted on a horse, looking down, going places it's never been, competing in events that it never probably competed in, you see a change. I can tell you stories that will make you cry. And I'm very interested now, since I found out that llamas, there is a, I think chases in the East are riding children on llamas. What's important there is the gait, and I cautioned them about it. You have to select the proper gait for this, and some llamas are very rough riding, if you watch them, but some also have smooth, and that's true with horses too. So that's an interesting area, Deborah. We won't have time to go into this, but there's a long history of this. And this is kind of Norwegian day, as you probably figured out here. And I had to get in there. One of the pioneers was Bodker, Elisabeth Bodker, in starting riding for the handicap for a polio victim. They and the English in UK were the first to do this. But they were riding horses by prescription for therapy before Christ. At least in 5 BC. I threw this picture in. This is on also because this is a Scandinavian day. This is Erling and Anna Stordal, who started Beteståland up on the Valdres north of Oslo. And they do a lot of physical therapy and everything for handicapped people, but they also use horses and dogs. It's very important in the therapy there in the sports class called Beteståland. And here's one of the godfathers of the whole movement in modern times, Boris Levinson, and the better looking of the two is his dog Jingle, right? And he was a clinical psychologist at Sheba University, and he always had a dog, loved dogs, but he never had him present when he was expecting a patient. On this particular day, he wasn't expecting a patient for an hour and a half or two, so he had Jingles with him, and suddenly the door opened and here came his next patient. An hour and a half or two early. If you had had the kid, you'd probably come early too. And she was filling out forms. The kid picked up with the dog and having a pretty good time of it. And then she realized it was happening, so she was about to intervene. And he stopped her. He says, let him go at it. and that really launched him on utilizing animals in assistance therapy. And he wrote quite a few papers. A lot of people made fun of him. But now he's regarded as very highly for this. He wrote a couple of books, one of them dedicated to Jingles. And he made a plea that we have organized, structured studies. One of the people that responded to this was, two people really, Sam Porcelain Wright and his wife Elizabeth at Ohio State University at the psychiatric hospital. And the patient there heard the dogs barking and said, you know, that's for us. And they hesitated for a while, but they eventually involved them and had some remarkable effects with quite a number of patients who the psychiatrists were happy to be relieved of because they weren't getting anywhere with them. And they had he had success with almost all but one or two. But then he ran out of money and he advertised his dogs, and they were well selected dogs, well defined. And a fellow who ran the Castle Nursing Home in Millersburg, Ohio, is there for me because he saw how people responded to his dog when he went around the premises. And I'm only going to tell you about one of them, that's Jed. He had been at Castle Nursing Home for over 20 years. As far as most people were concerned, he was aphasic. He said a word now and then or a grunt. And when they brought him this dog, he says, "You brought that dog," which is four more words than he'd said in over 20 years. And then he was socialized by this. He asked if he could keep him, and he started tracing pictures of dogs, freehand drawings of dogs. Here's one of them. Very important thing, you see, he caught the gist of it. You know. They're both laughing. I mean, they're enjoying life. And it reminded me of one of my closest friends, whose name is Michael McCulloch. He was one of the really founders of the Delta Foundation back in 76, was from people from the University of Minnesota, and his older brother, Bill, who was a veterinarian. But he was much of an inspiration for this. And he always thought that his kids should have pets. And then more recently, he got a kid for his pet. an important organ. And he did a survey and showed, you know, here's what the influence of pets are to a lot of his patients. And you can read them as fast as I can, probably faster, because I got to go faster. And all have high scores here, and here's some more of them. And that's what they do for you. And the story has a very sad ending, however. He was had a very busy practice, large practice in downtown Portland. He was also on our regional program in veterinary medicine and also with the Oregon Medical Center. About 4 years ago, next Monday, on the 26th of June, a former crazed patient came into his office and blew his brain out. We took a tremendous loss, and I lost one of my closest. One of the remarkable things about an animal, if you introduce an animal into almost any situation, it changes the milieu of the situation. This is a friend of mine named Carolina Peacock on your left, who's worked a lot with delinquent youth, and she wanted to take her PhD, so she went to Boston College and says, I want to do my PhD thesis on interviewing, in-depth interviews on juvenile delinquents before serious offenders before their hearing. 12 with my dog present and 12 without my dog. Of course, she's a different person without her dog. But the information she got was far richer. People would spill out, you know, because they trust you if you have a pleasant dog. And that's now, she's in busy practice now, especially with juvenile women who have had a very bad time of it. But they trust her, they trust the dog, and they'll tell the problems to the dog. And it's probably the most petted dog. I mean, they sit there. I've seen a lot of videos on them. They're sitting there petting the dog, telling them they're trouble. And now, if you go to Toledo, Washington, there's a guy there who's a counselor. And he has over 50 animals of 8 species. And if you drive the 800 feet down his driveway, you make an appointment. And you see all these animals on both sides. And then you park your car. And there's some llamas that really love people. One of them is a handicapped one. They come running over the fence, so you almost have to go over there and pet them. And by the time you get into him to get issued a little dachshund or a cat, you have fewer problems. I mean, your anxiety level is to be, your blood pressure is lower. He also uses, he sometimes takes a family out and sits on bales of hay out in the loafing shed for the llamas, just the presence of them. And I want to make one point here. That's the people there, Holtzels, doing some interesting work. But why do people, we are, I said, nature nurtures by nature. And we have this thing of neoteny. More and more, we retain juvenile characteristics in adulthood. And we've bred our dogs to have big heads, big eyes, and a playful disposition into adulthood, right? Poodles, Persian cats. We've ruined a lot of species this way. But it's, they retain their juvenile appearance and incite nurture. They encourage nurture, don't they? You can't keep your hands off. It's just like everybody has to touch a child. Most people have to touch our dog, especially children. You want to nurture that dog. If you notice, it's got big eyes and a large forehead. And that's also, I think, some of the magic. I've been trying to explain to myself, to llama people. Look at that eye. Huh? A curious, a listener, a non-threatening, just loves you. And you can't help but loving it back. Prescription pet program, we're into more and more hospitals now in the cancer ward at the Denver Children's Hospital. Now, when they thought it wouldn't last long, the doctor said this is one of the best things that's happened to us. They extended it to all the services except the intensive care and newborn. And when I, it's another thing I'm going to do in intensive care, we're going to have pregnant guppies given birth. Or this is now the president of Delta Society, and he's the first consultant of the Surgeon General for human-animal bond. And so the Army is into this, and he's done a fantastic thing to Dr. Polly Dog with the children in the psychiatric hospital in Brooks Army Medical Hospital. He's in the animals in the old soldiers' home and the airmen's home. He's done a lot of interesting studies. Fantastic things are happening in hospitals, and I can't go into all of them. This happens to be at the Rehabilitation Research for Head Trauma Unit people. And more the evidence is gathering that with the presence of an animal, like this kid said, before a spinal tap, I want the dog here because then they won't let it. He won't let them hurt me. And that's what they find in the hospital. It seems the presence of the animal blocks the pain. Now, I don't know the mechanism, but it happened. There's a lot of things that we now have scientific studies to show this. We have meetings. Our next international meeting is in Monaco. Monte Carlo, we have 23 countries represented, 150 papers probably. At our international meeting in Boston that we sponsored, we had 16 or 18 countries, 200 papers, 1,000 people. Contributes to marital resolution, that's a good thing. Although animals can also bust up a marriage, especially if it's a non-human primate. But if you got an animal, the chances are you resolve it is better than if you didn't have one. And there's always fights over who gets visiting privileges. But here's the Delta Society, which I've been spreading. It started in 76 as a foundation, and now it's a society. And I was served as president for 7 or 8 years. I was hoping Michael McCulloch would be the president a long time ago. But there's what we're involved in. I have now added another triangle, which is children, animals, and peace. It's a safe discussion because neither children nor animals respect territorial boundaries. Most of them don't. I mean, they respect state lines. And they have, you can throw animals together, or children, even from different countries, and they can communicate. We can't, but they can. And the Delta Society has many locals, and more are added. We've got, the Midwest looks sort of bare, but we're getting some more there. We're also into, recently in Japan. I've been a couple of times in Australia, just recently to Holland and Norway. Can't go to Europe without going to Norway. And Canada now has one, and they have a Delta down under in Australia, just got the word on that. So things are happening in this movement. We have a scientific journal, a referee journal, I call that. We also have a magazine 4 times a year, People, Animals, and Environment. And I also teach a course in Reverence for Life, taught it at 7 different universities. And recall one of my fellow professors at the University of California system was Ira Coffer. One of the last things he said before he died was, it may well be that the survival of the species will depend upon our ability to foster a boundless capacity for compassion. Others have said it may well be our last great hope. And I believe that. So the lesson, the take-home lesson, is from Mail House in Rochester, Minnesota. Is one that Michael McCullough often closed his lectures with, and that's our assignment: to cure sometimes, to relieve often, but to comfort always. That's our assignment, and I wish you well in it.